Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is episode 97 on opsins with Dr. James Fleming of Keio University in Japan. In this interview, we first establish what opsins are and then how they work before we turn our attention to the fossil record and what we can learn about the vision of extinct animals. This is a fairly abstract episode in that we're talking about proteins and phylogenetics, both of which are fairly hard to visualize, but hopefully it's something that we can get across reasonably clearly. But if you do find that you are struggling, please take a look at our website where we've got images and trees, which should all make things a little more clear. In general PaleoCast activity, we've just released our recordings of PALAS 2018 and also a guided field trip of the Ediacaran largestata Mistaken Point. So head over to our YouTube channel to check those both out. Between them, there's a ton of great video content there. So please leave the presenters some feedback if you like their videos, since that's always so nice for them to have. We've also started producing content for our latest super secret project, and it's been huge amounts of fun to record so far. We'll be releasing details of the project fairly soon, so keep your eyes and ears open for that one. As usual, your episode requests are always welcome, especially as we approach our 100th episode. And likes, shares, reviews, and donations are also encouraged. Please make sure that you're following us on social media, especially now that we've got Instagram and LinkedIn accounts. But if you're an anomaly carotid, then you might not be able to appreciate the full colour of our posts. Or mightn't you? Well, this is the perfect episode to find out. Hi, James. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure to be here.
Right, I think we should take a little bit of time to get to know you, bits about your history, how you got into paleontology, what you're doing, and who you are as a person. So let's start at the start. How did you get into paleontology?
So I think probably my first start in paleontology was with my dad. My dad used to work in quarries, and every now and then he'd find things like devil's toenails or other small interesting fossily bits and bring them back to show me. And I think from there, my interest really grew into wanting to do it as a profession. I did the 4-year master's degree at Bristol University in paleontology and evolution. And then I did my PhD at Bristol as well, which is this topic we're talking about today, I think.
And what would you be doing if you weren't a paleontologist?
So my big hobby is tabletop role-playing games. And I think if I wasn't a paleontologist, I'd probably be working a more regular job and doing that kind of stuff as a sideline or as more of a focus in my life.
So we're talking Dungeons and Dragons, yeah?
Yeah. Dungeons and Dragons, and I play quite a lot of an independently published game called Apocalypse World. That's good fun. That's like a kind of Mad Max game.
Wow. Mm. Who knew that paleontologists could be nerds as well?
There's a surprising amount of crossover. Quite a lot of my groups end up being individuals who were or are on paleontology courses somewhere in the world.
So have you ever done any sort of paleontological themed dungeon mastering? Do you take people on adventures and say you walk into a strange land and realize that you're back in the Devonian and you encounter a trilobite, roll a 12 to deal it damage? Or I don't know how it works. I've probably done a load of dungeon mastering faux pas there.
It's not a regular occurrence, but I did have one occasion where I beset my players with a rather aggressive, very large Anomalocaris.
It happens.
It happens.
I'm just thinking, maybe this would be a pretty cool new podcast where we talk people through. Do they do podcasts for Dungeon Master Eden things?
Yeah. Actual play podcasts for RPGs are quite popular these days. And quite a lot of more video-orientated actual play casts have become quite popular, especially since the voice actor Matt Mercer got a big YouTube one going called Critical Role that I've not watched myself, but I know a lot of people who do watch it.
So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, wow, that sounds amazing, I'd love to do a PaleoCast Dungeons and Dragons campaign, then write in, let us know, and we'll get James back on to do one.
Yeah, sounds like a good time. I'd be well up for that.
Right. Back on script. So you are working in Vision and in arthropods. Why did you choose to do that as opposed to something more interesting, say like dinosaurs?
So I've always really been interested in arthropods from quite an early age. I used to trap ants and keep ant farms and worm farms and similar things. But it was only until really in my master's degree that I realized that I could combine the two when my undergraduate tutor, Mike Benton, who you've had on the show many times, I'm sure, offered me the chance to work on some Jurassic crickets and locusts. And I thought, oh, wow, this is really exciting. And so when the PhD offer came up to work on the evolution of vision in arthropods and their relatives, I kind of leapt at the opportunity. I didn't really know much about vision beforehand, but I've really fallen into it, and I really enjoy the visual ecological side of the topic as well.
Yeah, you and me both. So let's talk about the ecology of vision, how that influences how animals live. How does sight influence arthropods?
So arthropods rely on their sense of sight for a lot of different activities. And we can see that, of course, most obviously in the insects, with these very quite complicated compound eyes. The visual systems of arthropods are used for all sorts of things, like individual identification of predators and also of other members of the same species, and also to navigate their environment rather than using smell or hearing as some other animals do.
So it's just as important to them as it would be, say, to us?
Very much so.
Okay, and is there a distinction between how insects and other arthropods are able to view their world and how we and other vertebrates are able to view ours?
So this varies quite a lot among different arthropods. So when we think of animals such as insects, we have to think about them in a very different way to how we think of chelicerates, which are the group that contains the spiders and scorpions, because they have very, very different kinds of eyes. And then again, with the centipedes and millipedes, who also have very different eyes, both from each other and from all of the other arthropods. But in general, the compound eye, which is what people are often really talking about when they talk about arthropod eyes as a generalization, although that only really applies to crustaceans and insects. These are eyes that are much more focused on determining the speed of moving objects than they are interested in the spatial awareness and the distance of objects from them.
Right. And is there a difference in the basic anatomy of them as well?
The vertebrate eye is best thought of like a camera, a single lens that contains a lot of different receptors. However, when most people talk about an arthropod eye, what they really mean is a compound eye. A compound eye is made up of lots of smaller lenses, each of which contains those receptors that independently are responding to those smaller angles of light.
So the way I like to explain it is that a compound eye produces a compound image. Each individual eye works kind of like a pixel on a computer screen and contributes like a mosaic to the overall image.
Yes, quite so.
So that's kind of the front-end functionality of the eye and the lenses. But when you get into the receptors, how do they differ between vertebrates and invertebrates? And what is the variation within those subgroups as well?
Both vertebrates and invertebrates use opsins. Opsins are the most common kind of photoreceptive protein. Not all vertebrates and invertebrates use opsin, but the vast majority do, with a very few rare exceptions. In vertebrates, the system that the listeners are probably a bit more familiar with, the vertebrates respond to light by a process called bleaching, which means that the opsin, the rod or cone, is hit by the photon of light and detaches from its pigment. It changes to signal to the rest of the visual system that the light has been received. Whereas in invertebrates, there's no need for a recharge. What happens is the opsin changes and is then recharged by another photon of light which hits the opsin. So they are kind of self-recharging, as opposed to the vertebrate opsins, which require external methods to recharge them.
So when we're looking at an image, it's composed of different light intensities and also different wavelengths, so different colors. How are our opsins, how do they function so that we're able to be able to tell that this is red here and this is green there?
Our visual systems are built up of lots of separate opsins, and each opsin responds to a different wavelength band. In humans, for example, we have a red band, a green band, a blue band, and also a night vision band, which is known as a rod, as opposed to the three cones. And that's why you'll see a computer screen or Paint or Photoshop will give you the option to move things in red, green, and blue, because these are actually our primary colors, not red, blue, and yellow. And everything that we see is a mix between those three colors. Other animals have different opsins that will respond to different curves. And that means that they might see different color, the same colors that we see, in a different way.
So if we used, for instance, grasshopper Photoshop, it would have different sliders. You maybe have like red, green, greeny, yellow, blue, something else, some ultraviolet in there maybe.
Almost for certain, yeah. A grasshopper-designed Photoshop would probably focus on blue-green, a kind of greeny-yellow, like a bit of a snotty colour, a UV, and a darker blue, I think.
Okay, why do they focus on those colours as opposed to red, green, and blue? I mean, do we see everything that's about? Are we missing a lot of visual information just with the red, green, and blue that we focus on?
Humans really miss a lot of visual information, actually. We view the world in a very human-centric sense, because that's really the only way we can view the world. But more animals see in the ultraviolet than don't. And so really, it's actually better to think of humans, much as we rely on our sight very often, as actually relatively visually deficient. It's noted that in some of our closest ancestors, in other apes and monkeys, the red photoreceptor is either not present at all or present more commonly in females than it is in males. And even in humans, red color blindness is very common, especially among males. And some people have suggested that there might be evolutionary, ecological reasons that women might more readily, evolutionarily need to perceive red, the color which is primarily associated with ripe fruits, than men do. And that humans have developed a tri-color visual system actually as a result of this kind of evolutionary adaptation. Insects use four visual opsins: an ultraviolet one, a more yellowy-greeny one, a more bluey-greeny one, and a more dark, deep blue one. That last opsin, the blue opsin, is actually shared by crustaceans and insects, but is not present in centipedes and millipedes and the spiders and scorpions and their relatives. So we think that that's an evolutionary adaptation that's actually quite specific to that group.
Right. It sounds like there's a whole lot of things going on with different opsins in all of the different groups. And then there's evolutionary things going on. Why did this group get that opsin? Why did this one get that? So that's what we're going to focus on today. So you look at the optics and opsins of the ecdysozoans. So we've been talking about arthropods so far, but what is an ecdysozoan and how does that relate to arthropods?
The wider group that contains the arthropods. So that's the arthropods plus the tardigrades, which I'm sure quite a lot of listeners will be aware of, these very famously resilient tiny animals. Yes. The water bears, the moss
water
piglet.
Bears, they can survive in space.
I'm recording them from Japan,
stuff
where
like
they call
that,
them kumamushi, literally bear insect. The
right.
Onychophora, who are the velvet worms, who are a small, mostly endangered group of tropical animals. The nematodes and nematomorphs. That's the roundworms and Gordian worms. So roundworms are probably most familiar to the listeners as the kind of worms that you give deworming pills to your cats to get rid of. And nematomorphs are a group of arthropod-specific parasites that were the main inspiration for the chestburster alien from Aliens. They creep inside an arthropod and they grow to maturity and then rip out of their stomach. It's really very gruesome and quite impressive and pretty cool.
And if you've never seen episode 3 of PaleoCast, mm-hmm. check out the images on that, because you get these nematode worms in arthropods in amber. And when the arthropods gets entrapped, it starts dying. All of these nematodes are like, we better get out of here. So they all burst out, but then they're too trapped in the amber. And it's like pressing pause on the DVD when you're watching Alien at just the right moment. You've got all of these things exploding out of them. It's absolutely amazing. But it's interesting to know that nematode worms are closer related to arthropods than they are to, say, earthworms.
The worm is a really fun taxonomic term that seems to refer to invertebrates with no legs, but a lot of the worms aren't really very closely related. Within the Ecdysozoa, there's also another group of worms called, in English, the penis worms, or Priapulida.
Why are they called penis worms? Do we have to ask?
Because they very much resemble a human penis.
Right.
And when they feed, they evert themselves partially. And yeah, it very much does look like someone pulling their foreskin back. It's great.
But these also have eyes? What need does a little parasitic nematode? Is fully encased within its host or something. Why does that need eyes and opsins? Is it just...
So the nematodes themselves were actually one of the odd groups that I spoke about earlier. They do receive light signals, but they actually do it, at least in some species of nematodes that we're aware of, through a very much non-opsin method. And there aren't any species of nematodes that possess opsins. Nematomorphs, however, the arthropod parasites, do appear to have opsins. And that's actually something that we only found out during my PhD with my research with one of the earliest nematomorph genomes.
Wow.
Mm.
So... if they have opsins, obviously they've evolved from something that would have had an eye, presumably?
Presumably. And they still have photoreceptive spots themselves. So the free-living form of the nematomorph still needs to navigate to find its way to water and to find its way to a host and to find its way to breed. So it... even though we might not be talking about seeing an image, it still perhaps has an ecological need to understand which way is light and which way is dark.
Right. We've got a lot of context about the biology of opsins and images and vision as a whole, but let's now look at the fossil record. And you have been looking at how vision evolved in the Ecdysozoans using a process called phylogenetics. Could you first give us an explanation of what phylogenetics is, how it works, and then I promise we'll get onto some of the cool stuff about how ancient animals were able to see.
Well, this is all the cool stuff, and I'm very sorry, listeners, but you've been tricked. Phylogenetics is the study of how different living things are related to each other. Most of the listeners are probably familiar with the idea that mammals are more closely related to birds than they are to invertebrates. And that's phylogenetics. So we use mathematical models to determine where different morphological characters and molecular data might have evolved in what pattern to determine how closely related other things are to other things.
So a quick and fast example would be like this dog has hair and produces milk. Humans have hair and produces milk. This lizard doesn't have hair, doesn't produce milk. Therefore, humans and dogs are closer related than they are to lizards. And then you draw a tree that shows that relationship. And then also every scale, whether it's at the species, at the genus, family, all the way up, there's characteristics that define each of those groups. And they are united by those characteristics to the exclusion of another group that doesn't have it. And there's so many different characteristics that are morphological or molecular. So if you look at the differences in DNA, all of this information comes together and produces these huge trees that can take months and months to calculate. But we're talking about fossils. And their opsins. We're talking about proteins in fossil eyes. They don't preserve. How do you get the data to put into your models?
The fossils don't preserve the opsins, but actually the living members of the species preserve the opsins for us. So the proteins within an organism contain the history of that protein. And earlier, when I spoke about the idea that the insects have, for example, a kind of yellow-green opsin, a kind of bluey-green opsin, these different opsins have their own history. And if we can trace that history, we can work out when each of these new opsins originated. Each of these new opsins originated from a duplication event when one opsin became two. So a crab that has a blue opsin and a bee that has a blue opsin will find that they are more closely related to each other, these two blue opsins, than the crab's blue opsin is related to any of the crab's other opsins. And this is because the duplication that caused the origination of the blue opsin predates the split between the bee and the crab.
Right. Wow. So I'm just thinking that we've got our tree, our evolutionary tree in front of us, and I've got my blue marker and I've got my green marker. So we take the line that eventually ends up with a crab, draw it blue all the way back, get one for the bee, draw it blue all the way back. And you could keep drawing that blue line before the bee and the crab lines split off. And it would go all the way back into some presumably unknown ancestor. How far would you keep going?
For the blue one particularly, the blue one would actually turn up to be in the shared ancestor of the bee and the crab particularly. It's an opsin type that isn't present in any of the other arthropods, and so is actually a really exciting and interesting note of how closely related these two groups are.
Yeah, there's it's really interesting how insects and crabs, crustaceans, are closely related. We spoke about this in our last episode on decapods, that we could potentially think of insects as just terrestrial crustaceans, terrestrialized crustaceans in a way. So, yeah, so their blue opsin is a characteristic that only they share.
Yes. So it's just shared between crustaceans and insects, which is really exciting. And we can also date these duplications the same way that you might date how fossil species have originated.
And how's that done?
So we can use calibrations of when particular groups have diverged from other groups. So if we know, for example, that the crustaceans and insects share this blue opsin, then we know that the shared ancestor of the crustaceans and insects must have shared this blue opsin. And that means that when we find the first crustacean insect in the fossil record, the blue opsin must have occurred at or around this point.
Okay, so we know that there's crustaceans in the Cambrian. So the evolution of that blue opsin would have occurred at least earliest in the Cambrian, but probably a lot older as well.
Yes, presumably later, yeah. And we can then use mathematical models in the same way that we do when we date the divergence of species that add a layer of uncertainty onto what we find in the fossil record. Because, of course, when we find a fossil, we only ever really find the one instance of that species occurring. If you found a dead knee today, you wouldn't assume that humans only existed in 2018. It makes more sense to assume that they've been around for a few million years first.
So you looked at the evolution of all the different opsins shared by the ecdysozoa, the arthropods, velvet worms, tardigrades, onychophorans, and all of that lot. So when did the different relative opsins evolve? Do you have an order?
We do. So all of the duplications, bar the special blue one that we've talked about a bit already, actually occurred between the separation of onychophorans from the ecdysozoan group and the separation of arthropods from the ecdysozoan group, which is this big block of time that's only really occupied by fossil species. And this was where the idea for the project itself came from, because we have a change from the one opsin that's possessed by onychophorans and tardigrades to this four opsin group that's possessed by the arthropods. And we don't really understand anything about this big black space in between them.
So what actually exists, which extinct groups existed in the space on the tree between the onychophorans that have survived till today and the arthropods, which have survived until today?
And this is where the best bit of my PhD comes in, because this is where all of the really cool Cambrian animals exist. This is where you have Kerygmakela and Pamdalurium. You also have Opabinia and all of the Anomalocaridids. So everything that's kind of Anomalocaris and Anomalocaris-like. And you also have Fushanhuia, which is not quite an arthropod and also not quite an Anomalocaridid. And we think it's somewhere between the two. And they're absolutely brilliant.
So these are all the Burgess Shale and Chenjiang favourites.
Yeah, and with quite a few of the best bits of Austin thrown in as well.
Okay, but we can say that they are either going to have one opsin or four opsins. How can you determine exactly how many opsins and thus how many different bands of colour they could see?
So if you compare the duplication time of the opsin that you've calculated and the divergence time of the species, you'll end up with a series of confidence intervals where you can work out how likely it is that certain species possessed certain opsins. In our paper, we actually picked for our figures and interpretation in the discussion the most conservative amount of opsins that all of these specimens, all of these species could have. But, of course, there is indeed within that a confidence interval. So they could reasonably have possessed more than the number that we give it. But according to our mathematical models, it is this number or more.
Okay, so you're saying that the chances of the green opsin evolving before anomalocaridids, for example, evolved is this given percent. And so therefore, anomalocaris is however much percent likely to have been able to have seen this colour.
Yes. So to give the listeners an idea of how we did that, we only gave them the opsin if, according to our confidence intervals, the most recent possible date of the confidence interval for our opsin duplication was older than the oldest possible date of the species divergence from the tree.
So let's explore some of the different colours that these different ecdysozoans were able to see. Let's start with Anomalocaris, everyone's favourite from the Cambrian. What could it see?
We found out that Anomalocaris, and we assumed like Opabinia, probably saw with two opsins. And we don't know necessarily what colours these opsins were, but we do know that they were the shared ancestor of the modern blue-green, yellow-green sensitive and the shared ancestor of the modern ultraviolet sensitive opsins.
So can we colour the world in anomalocarid colours and say this is how the world would have looked to it?
So it's a bit more of a stretch, and it leans into more and more relying on probability, but we can have some idea. The assumption that we make is that the ancestor of the modern yellow-green and blue-green opsins was probably closer to blue-green. And the reason that we say this is that when you are living underwater, one of the first things that it makes sense to evolve, if you want to see, is the colour of the background. Because when you can perceive what the background is, which underwater is blue, you can also perceive what all of the things around you are, because they are not the colour of the background. And considering that the UV sensitive opsin is related to the other UV sensitive opsins and the blue sensitive opsin, but the blue sensitive opsin is much, much more recent, we can assume that the second opsin that Anomalocaris and Opabinia had was ultraviolet sensitive. So a blue and ultraviolet palette is most likely for Opabinia and Anomalocaris.
And how does this influence ecological interpretations of Anomalocaris?
It suggests that Anomalocaris, we already know from the size of its eyes, we have long predicted that it's an active predator. And it's an active predator that uses its eyesight. But it shows us that it's an active predator that not only uses its eyesight, but actually has quite well-developed eyes for its time, molecularly as well as morphologically. So the one thing that I'd like to say about Anomalocaris, actually, is Anomalocaris is perhaps one of the victims of our method, where perhaps we might have been too conservative. We found that the very far edge of Anomalocaris's likely divergence existed prior to our third opsin origination. But the confidence interval of the divergence of Anomalocaris mostly exists within our three opsin region, which suggests that there's actually a possibility that Anomalocaris may have had an even more impressively developed visual system than even our own study shows. And that's perhaps a failing of our own methodology.
If we look at some morphological evidence as well, you've said that Anomalocaris has pretty well-developed eyes. Is there a correlation between the morphology of the eyes of extinct organisms to the number of opsins that you've interpreted them to have. The animals with huge eyes, well-developed eyes, have more opsins.
Our study certainly suggests that there is. So the animals that we note as possessing only a single opsin are possessed of either what we call simple eye spots or reflective patches, which is a paleontological idea that Dr. Vinther came up with, that refers to the intermediate state between onychophorans and the fossilized state seen in Kerygmakela and Pandalurian. In Opabinia, we see the first duplication and also a much more complex eye than that seen in Kerygmakela, Pamdelurian, or in the onychophorans. And then again in Fujianhuia, which we've predicted to definitely have three opsins, we see a much more complex, what is known in the literature as a proto-arthropod eye. It's not quite the arthropod eye yet, but it's very, very close. And then, of course, with four opsins, we actually predicted that none of the fossilized species that we studied possessed the four opsins that are seen in arthropoda.
And you've worked out the timings for when these opsins evolved. How does that relate? Because we're so close down to the bottom of the Cambrian when we're talking here. How does that relate to the Cambrian explosion? Because a lot of people have suggested that the evolution of vision is one of the driving forces for the Cambrian explosion. How do the timings relate to each other? Could it be?
This actually really does suggest that this might be a real driving force. The first duplication and the second duplication are both Precambrian, and the third duplication appears to occur just before the turn of the Cambrian era itself. We predicted that the upper bound of our confidence interval of the third duplication was 558 million years, when of course the start of the Cambrian is 541. So the third duplication would have brought the ancestors of the arthropods from three opsins up to the modern four opsins that are possessed by modern arthropods. So it very much could have been one of the smoking guns of the Cambrian explosion itself. What's interesting is that this appeared to have occurred after the divergence of all of the fossil species that we studied. One flaw of our experiment, however, is that we can't account for independent duplications within fossil groups. I imagine a lot of the listeners are quite familiar with modern extant species such as the mantis shrimp that have lots of independent duplications. And for very morphologically visual species such as Anomalocaris, it could very much be the case that these anomalocaridids have multiple separate duplications that are independent only to a fossil species that is now completely extinct.
So with the mantis shrimp belonging to Crustacea, they had four opsins as standard, but the mantis shrimp went a bit crazy with that and independently, is it something like 16 different bands of colour that they can perceive?
So in some species, they have 16 different opsins. It doesn't always necessarily mean 16 different bands of colour, but yeah, they have 16 opsins.
And so it might be possible that any fossilised organism that isn't around today could have also evolved its own opsins.
Yes, very much so. And indeed, in some cases, we've seen fossil species that have presumably lost opsins independently as well. So there are some species of trilobites that don't have any eyes, for example, and one would assume that they might well not have any opsins as well because of that.
Is there a relationship between the morphology of the mantis shrimp eye and the number of opsins that that has, and then things that we see in the fossil record? So mantis shrimp are able to divide their eyes into different functional areas. You have some bands of really high light sensitivity, you have bands of really high acuity resolution. Do you see any of that in the fossil record? And could you use that as a proxy to say these probably likely were able to divide up their visual world into tons of things?
So it's possible that we could make those kind of predictions, but I think that that would probably be in the realm of somebody who had much greater experience with both modern morphological eye structures and also extinct morphological eye structures than I do, I think.
Yeah, I get that that was a bit hand-wavy.
I actually think that's a really good question. It's a very good point where you can actually delineate that, yeah, like what I do is mess with genes.
Well, there's a PhD for someone there. You're welcome.
Giving them away, you are.
So using this approach where you paint effectively a molecule onto a phylogenetic tree, you've used that with opsins, but can you use it with any other molecules or proteins or anything else like that in the fossil record?
Certainly. So opsins are a really good example of this because opsins already have had a lot of work done on their phylogenetic evolutionary history to be based off, and there's a great grounding of opsin science that is already there, both in the extant fossil, study of opsins and in people who have studied fossil eyes. However, it could be possible to work with other protein families that have important known duplication points, both in perhaps the kind of more charismatic side of things such as other senses like smell and gustation, the sense of taste, but also in perhaps less exciting proteins such as tolerance receptors and other kinds of useful but less exciting proteins.
Vision is the most exciting one. I agree.
It is, very much so.
So what's next for you? How do you take this forward? What are you going to be concentrating on next?
So I'm working in my postdoc on tardigrades. My PhD was the first to work with a number of new tardigrade genomes, where I found that there were a number of opsins in some of these tardigrade genomes. And previously, there had been one published tardigrade genome that had had one opsin, and we'd assumed that tardigrades had one visual opsin and three non-visual opsins that are in a different group. But it turns out that some species of tardigrades may have multiple visual opsins. So I've been working on trying to increase our sampling and our understanding of tardigrade vision. And that's where I am now.
Okay, James, thanks so much for coming on the show and painting that beautiful coloured picture of extinct arthropod, Ecdysozoan vision.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
So if you were to put an invertebrate in a room with just, say, green light, would it eventually become blind? He's thinking hard. It's one of those special questions, so simple, yet so hard to answer.
I don't think so.
And there you have your... your tentative answer. Pulled out of a hat at the last minute.
Yeah. If I'm completely honest, that is very much a question you'd have to ask a visual biologist and not a paleontologist.
That can go in at the end.